We are talking about Nightmare Alley, which was recently released by Criterion. I knew nothing about this movie except that Guillermo del Toro is, his remake of it is coming out in a few weeks. And I imagine we'll talk about that at some point. But I think I just want an excuse to watch a Tyrone Power movie because I've heard the name forever, but I didn't know anything about him. I still don't really, except I've seen him in a movie.
Right. Right. I knew about, the title Nightmare Alley, and I knew about, like you, the upcoming Guillermo del Toro remake. It was just one of those things where I knew it was kind of like a cult classic, but I, never got around to, I hadn't got around to watching it. So I was glad that, Criterion, released this. And I was, it's funny because after I watched it, it's a black and white movie from the 40s. And I was thinking, I asked a couple other, film experts, and I'm like, hey guys, is this a film noir? Would you consider this to be a film noir? And some think, yeah. And some think, no. So I get that. I think just the way it's the tone and the way it's lit and everything, I feel like it has some film noir conventions. But I looked at it like after it was done, I was thinking like this was like a really great like special episode of Twilight Zone in a way.
I thought the same thing. And first, I want to get into all of that, but I want to back up a second because I haven't had one of these discussions, at least not in a long time, so long ago that I've forgotten what the parameters are. What is, in your definition, film noir? What are the characteristics?
You're doing this to me.
Well, I'm just saying you talk to people about, is this film noir? Is it not? Mm-hmm. And some people said yes, and some people said no. I assume that they had reasons for it. So what would you say are the hallmarks of noir as they apply to this movie? And what are some of the reasons that this might not qualify?
Typically, a kind of like a flawed kind of anti-hero or heroine. Some kind of, possible double cross or crime, a femme fatale usually. Obviously, visually, the pastiche is usually like a heavy emphasis on, lighting to kind of set the mood and the emotional tone, which you do get a lot of that here. That's what I get from. I mean, you can say that, okay, well, it's usually like a detective or a con or Black Widow type character or something, I think, most, there's also neo-noir, which is what you would typically consider to be like, a movie that would come out after the film noir genre was typically in the black and white film, when black and white film was released, but may say like 40s, 50s, and then like in the, I would say late 60s, 70s, even 80s and 90s, there's some movies that you consider to be neo-noir, and they just call it neo-noir because it might be a story that keeps to the conventions, but came out after, the black and white movies and all that.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard, the 82 Blade Runner, referred to as neo-noir, Deckard in the trench coat and the detective and the narration, depending on which version you're watching. So it sounds like you've checked all the boxes of, if it's not by the definition of noir, because there's not really a detective character in here, it's at least noir adjacent. So what were some of the arguments you might have heard from people as to why this would not qualify?
Because
it takes place in a carnival.
it could be. I mean, I think it's funny because most of my responses were like, No, I don't really consider it a in film noir, but they didn't really say why. But but I mean, I would consider it, but I think it's kind of like on the edge of, you know, the strong checking of the boxes for what qualifies as a noir. But I think, based on, you know, the trailer that I saw for Guillermo del Toro's movie, it almost feels like we're getting more towards a stronger sense of conventional, say, like noir or even horror, for that matter.
You know, honestly, it's weird because, as I mentioned, I had no familiarity, no point of reference for this movie. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we're talking about this is because I saw that you had tweeted or posted on Facebook or something like a still from this image. Yeah. And it was an image of, you know, one of the main characters, Molly, who was like the electric girl at the carnival with these electric bolts passing through her fingers. I'm like, that's really weird and cool. And then I'm like, yeah, that makes sense that Guillermo del Toro would make a movie that has that in it. Mm-hmm. But then halfway through watching Nightmare Alley from 1947, I was like, how is Guillermo del Toro going to handle this material? Because this seems about as far removed from his sensibilities as you can get. So I went and I finally watched the trailer for his remake. And at the end of that, I'm like, the title's there. I'm sure the characters have the same name, but this seems like it seems all emphasis is on the carnival and kind of like theatrical aspects of this and the dreamlike, weird, mysterious stuff that is kind of out of the way by the time the movie is a half hour in.
I'm wondering if it's one of those movies where like the movie itself is a lot different than the trailer that they want to grab you with, which could be, you know, in fact, I kind of hope so. Now, that being said, I don't know how much of this you got into, but, you know, I mean, obviously I know you saw the whole movie, but as far as the additional features, commentary, I listened to most of the commentary and watched most of the special features. This is an adaptation of the novel by William Lindsay Gresham, who seems like a very interesting character in and of himself. And from what I gathered, a loyal adaptation of the novel, this is not. But I think at the time, there was just certain things that they couldn't put out there, you know, on you know, that studios would not allow or audiences would not be receptive to. So I'm gathering, and I did read some kind of brief snippet from Del Toro that stated that, you know, one of the reasons for the remake is he wanted to do a more loyal adaptation of the novel. So, yeah, we're going to see some interesting things probably that were probably part of the original book, but not part of the original movie.
That's fascinating because I was of two minds of it. I was like, okay, this is either front-loaded stuff, like they're showing the first 20 minutes of the carnival stuff. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of it is going to be faithful to, it's a lot of conversations in hotels and, you know, restaurants and, you know, just kind of like psychological warfare between these twisted characters.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, now I got to track down this book and see if I can cram it in before before I watch the movie because I'm intrigued.
I was going to say, man, I know, I was like, knowing Ian, he's going to try and cram this book in before the,
my reading list is already too gargantuan, but, but no, we should actually talk about what this movie is about. The 47 version, directed by Edmund Goulding. Yeah. There, you know, as we mentioned, it takes place at a carnival, and there is Zena, played by Joan Blondell, who she's got a partner, a husband. Her husband's name is Pete, played by Ian Keith, who's he's sort of like an on his way out of this world alcoholic, but they have this act where she pretends to be a psychic and they work the crowd and they got this very kind of ingenious method of, you know, everyone write their name on a piece of paper and based on, you know, he's down in this pit below the stage with a giant chalkboard writing the answers to these crystal stage, ball questions that she will, you know, mesmerize the crowd and astound people. Tyrone Power's character, Stanton, is... It's unclear how long he's been with this outfit. He seems comfortable enough to have been around for a while, but still sort of green enough to be a newcomer. He eventually, through somewhat of an accident, winds up getting very close to Xena with Pete out of the picture and convinces her to take up an old version of their previous act, in which they had worked out this elaborate code so that Xena could be up on stage and call out to the, you know, the kind of co-conspirator in the audience who was taking questions. And based on the inflections of the answers that they would give, the psychic could, you know, perform all these amazing feats
right.
of prestidigitation, I guess. Things kind of go south. They end up leaving the carnival. I'm jumping kind of around the story, but as they kind of settle in this, in the great, our great city of Chicago,
crazy.
Yeah, it really is. Especially the scene where they're driving, you can see the Chicago theater. I'm like, State Street hasn't looked like that in a long time. No. It's like a two-way street. Mm-hmm. There's, as you mentioned, when you're talking about your noir setup, there's kind of double crosses and triple crosses. And at the end of it, you're right, it does kind of feel like this moralistic, you know, like an after-school special version of a Twilight Zone episode, but that's not a knock. It is just kind of an odd feeling to find yourself at the end of a motion picture.
Oh, totally. You know, and it's kind of a perfect, the setting and tone of Nightmare Alley is a carnival. And I guess what I'm getting at is this, the setting and tone of the beginning and of the end is a carnival. Obviously, like you said, what happened in between is, you know, the main characters leave the carnival and they, you know, they go into this elaborate kind of scheme, kind of like a, you know, a charlatan scheme here where they become really popular as an act and everything. But just to see, like, it starts out kind of like, you know, maybe like the starting of a Twilight Zone episode, and it kind of ends like one. And I heard that the ending of the original book is a lot, it's a lot more of a downer than the movie. Because in the movie, it's pretty much like, you know, spoiler alert, she pretty much is there for him, you know, and
Molly,
Molly. And there may be a glimpse of hope for him. We don't know, but at least he's not alone and helpless. He's kind of helpless, but he's not alone. I mean, she's kind of there for him. I haven't read the book, but I heard that based on the special features here, the ending is much more of a downer.
So now, I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but I will say that by the time the film ends, and we are jumping all over the place here, folks, so I recommend checking out the movie, and if you're familiar with it, then you'll know exactly what we're talking about. But Stanton ends up back at the carnival after having made a lot of money and become very famous, kind of taking this, you know, psychic act on the road with Molly. He became the great Stanton, I think, performing, you know, sold out dates and basically entertaining high society.
Yeah.
He ends up an alcoholic back at the carnival, much like Pete from the beginning of the movie. But there's a scene where he's so down on his luck that he can't get any kind of a job because the carnival owner is like, yeah, I got psychics. They're a dime a dozen. What can you do? And he's like, well, nothing else really. And said, okay, well, we need a geek, which at the beginning of the movie, the geek was, you know, kind of the lowest form of life at the carnival, you know, the freak act, which brought to mind Todd Browning's Freaks. Stan eventually says, well, okay, you'll keep me in booze, you'll give me a place to sleep, I'll be your carnival geek. But very quickly he freaks out and he sort of goes on this miniature rampage, and I thought for sure that they were going to end up, like, he was either just going to be insane and get committed, or they were going to have to put him down because he's running around the carnival, there's people chasing him and he's like breaking stuff. The happy ending, even though I liked it it felt very much kind of tacked on. And I'm wondering if the book ends with something like he just, you know, goes crazy and they have to shoot him.
Yeah, something like that. Because I think, if I remember correctly, in the first, you know, half or the, you know, the first act, let's say this, it pretty much is a three act story. In the first act in the carnival, the character who plays the geek, which we never totally see, the geek that Stan is initially enamored by or interested in, there is, I think, a brief moment where, like, he's gotten loose, he's getting away, we got to round him up or something like that. So there's this tendency of the geek to just be kind of like, he's kind of like a half animal, a half human type of, he's so depraved and so, you know, down on his luck and so hooked on booze to keep him alive, that, you know, there's this whole thing where he's like, he'll eat a live chicken right in front of you, you know, and tear it up. And you know, it's like, okay, people want to see that, I guess. And even in the trailer for Del Toro's movie, it's like, okay, I guess we're going to get into that a lot more. It was funny because this whole idea of a carnival geek, I was totally unfamiliar with. I resented it a little bit. I mean, because I consider myself a geek. I mean, you know, comic books and pop culture, whatever. But that's a different kind of geek, I guess. So
I imagine it probably, you know, it probably comes from that same root.
Probably. But it's interesting how you could, you know, a carnival geek, you could, you know, consider it, you know, some type of a, you know, Cro-Magnon derelict or something like that. I don't know. But it's basically like a borderline, you know, savage who's appeased by his addiction, his or her addiction. So it is interesting how, you know, I don't know, again, the ins and outs of, you know, carnival life, but I guess back then a geek was a staple, just like the bearded lady or something. So I found that, you know, very intriguing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's cool how, you know, I think Tyrone Power was wonderful in this role, and it made me want to seek out, you know, more films that he was in. But one of the things I thought was really fun about this movie, and when I say fun, I mean just kind of cool. This is not a fun movie to watch, because you're watching a guy spiraling down this, you know, kind of chasm of immorality and compromise and dragging people with him, or at least so he thinks. But it reminded me of two movies. One was Leap of Faith with Steve Martin.
I could see that.
And the other one was A Face in the Crowd, the Andy Griffith movie. Both involve like these kind of big personality cons who get, you know, sort of swept up in forces that are greater than themselves. You know, with A Face in the Crowd, it's, you know, politics and betrayal and that kind of overtaking the ego that has been built up by both of those things. In Leap of Faith, it literally is, you know, a charlatan faith healer who comes directly face to face with an act of God and has to reckon with that. And it's sort of the same thing here, because you know, the Stanton character knows he can quote scripture, he can sort of read people and speak to their sense of morality, their sense of spirituality, and use that to get himself out of trouble. He can use that to advance his con. But then at the very end, there's no great big movement like God's hand coming down and like striking him or something, but you can just kind of see that in a kind of a cosmic sense, he pushes things too far and assumes his own kind of godlike status. Like, I'm invincible. All these people love me. I've got these, you know, I've got one woman on the side and another woman who's kind of helped me in this way, and another woman that's I used and disposed of, and she came back into my life, but I can still deal with that. I'm unstoppable. Until he's not. And that's why it does feel very much like a lesson movie, but it's a pretty dark one for being that.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, you can, and I'm sure for you know, movie fans back in the day, I mean, Tyrone Power is kind of like this, you know, somewhat of a he was definitely a movie star, but he was, you know, typically playing, you know, heroes and swashbucklers and everything like that. And then I know that, you know, based on the special features here, you know, Power had a huge hand in, you know, getting this movie made and being involved in it. And I think he just wanted to do something entirely different. And I'm sure it was really odd for audiences to, you know, see something. That's, you know, it's like, how often do we see, say, somebody like Tom Hanks play just like a despicable evil guy? You know, that would be the comparison. That's an extreme comparison because, you know, Tyrone Power in here, he's not necessarily, and I really love that line in this movie where he was, what does he say? He says, at one point he says, I wonder why I'm like that. I'm never thinking about anybody except myself. And, you know, he says that to, you know, the woman that he's with there. But I like it that it just comes out and says that, you know, he's not necessarily out of touch with how he comes across and who he is, but he's also not doing anything to change that either. You know, he's just like, you know, I'm just self-serving and, you know, I'm trying to make ends meet. And, you know, going back to what you're saying about how long he was in the carnival, you know, who knows? He could have been there at the time we meet him. He is, you know, kind of working his way through the carnival crowd right in front of the, you know, the kind of ringleader or announcer. And initially we think that, oh, this guy could be just visiting. Or, oh, no, I guess he's part of the, you know, Carney cast. And so, like, for all we know, he could have been with them for, like, a week and a half, a week. And he's really, it seems like anywhere, he seems like the kind of guy where anywhere he's at, he's looking for a way to further himself, to, you know, learn something to his advantage, you know, or, you know, it would be whether that would be something, you know, legal or illegal or deceptive or, you know, on the lowdown or whatever. It would be, again, to further his own success or goals. I like the fact that he just kind of came out there and kind of matter of fact and said it, because there is a certain, he's definitely a charismatic character, and there's a certain gee-golly quality to him, but is also at the same time there's also this like almost like paranoid, like tender, anxious side of him that starts to slowly come out, and it develops into this, you know, full-on downward spiral. But it's almost like this, you know, like looking over the side of his shoulder kind of paranoia that develops, almost like this. Well, obviously there's something that triggers this whole guilty conscience definitely in this movie, but you have a feeling that this is not the first time he's experienced a guilty conscience.
Well, it also, I think a lot of it, you know, we're meant to infer a lot of his backstory because we hear that, you know, he was, you know, raised in an orphanage. So he's got some kind of like abandonment issues. And then we meet him as, you know, a grown man. So you can imagine a life kind of on the street hustling. He's got talents in that he's good with people and good with sort of reading people and with performing. And so the carnival seems like the natural place for him to fit in. But once he figures out an angle, like, oh, I could really latch on to this Xena character and her act, and we could really make something out of it. And they do. And they eventually leave the carnival. As he gains more and more success, it's like he's never really stopped. It's unclear if he has like a criminal record or anything. He doesn't seem to be afraid of going to jail or going back to jail or anything like that. He doesn't seem to be afraid of much. I think it's that kind of street survival instinct that has gotten him so far that he keeps ascending to these great heights that he starts to, you know, feel that he deserves, you know, this success because he's had such a rotten life. So he's a complex, you know, character. And I want to go back to something you were saying about Tyrone Power playing against type. It kind of makes me appreciate more the idea that Del Toro cast Bradley Cooper in the remake, because there's an actor who has been, he's spent the last, you know, at least 5+ years trying to go against the type of roles that made him, you know, successful. He's no longer like, he's constantly, you know, getting into roles where he's like covering himself up with like a wacky mustache, or kind of like that sort of like sleazy drippy Jerry Curl from American Hustle. You know, now he's playing like a carnival geek kind of a character. He's taking that leading man kind of like comedy blockbuster guy and proving that I'm more than that. You know, it was A Star Is Born, I think, is another good example. You know, a washed up country star,
a washed up Sam Elliott. Yeah.
It's kind of perfect. And I'm even more excited, and damn it, I hope not disappointed.
Yeah. What's funny is, I mean, he also plays a great character in the upcoming Paul Thomas Anderson movie, Licorice Pizza. These movies are coming out the same month. And what's funny is, I think both of these roles were originally not written for, but the goal was to cast Leo DiCaprio in both of these roles. But, you know, for scheduling or whatever, couldn't work out. Now I could see, based on the fact that I've seen Licorice Pizza, and I haven't seen, you know, Del Toro's Nightmare Alley yet, but I could not see him playing the character he plays in Licorice Pizza. I can't see DiCaprio. I mean, Cooper was great in Licorice Pizza, but I could almost see a variation of Stanton Carlisle played by DiCaprio, but I'm more interested in seeing what Cooper would do. You know, based on, say, like the kind of performances we've seen out of, say, like DiCaprio in, like, say, Shutter Island or Wolf of Wall Street, you know, there could be some type of variation somewhere in between there of Stanton Carlisle. And he's handsome and charismatic, and he could play those types of characters just like Tyrone Power did. But I like you, I'm definitely more curious to see what Cooper would do with the role. And I don't know. I mean, I'm tempted. I definitely want to, you know, attack the original source material, but I don't know if I want to do that before the Del Toro movie.
Here's the thing, just to kind of close the book on the DiCaprio thing. I love Leo. I think he's done a lot of really interesting things, but he's sort of, you know, Bradley Cooper almost unwittingly is following the DiCaprio mold, because DiCaprio was, you know, he was a global sensation for Titanic, you know, 25 years ago almost. And then he started, you know, he kind of rode that train into like these kind of like lousy, like cashing in on my success movies, like The Man in the Iron Mask and all this other random stuff. But then he started getting into, you know, I know he was nominated for Gilbert Grape and all that stuff, but, you know, Titanic really made him, you know, the Tiger Beat poster boy, literally.
Sure.
But then, you know, his roles for the last, you know, 15, 20 years, he's, you know, been very selective. He's chosen stuff that kind of goes against the type. Robert Pattinson is kind of doing the same thing. But the thing about Cooper and Pattinson is they are very early on in this process. So when I think about a Bradley Cooper movie, I still kind of have The Hangover in my head, or kind of like these these earlier things. And I think, oh, wow, it's cool that he's doing these other roles. With Leo DiCaprio, I'm like, yeah, he's just, you know, that's just what he does now. You know, he's doing these. It's not that it's not interesting. It's just that I don't consider it to be, you know, special anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I could totally see that. I think Cooper has always had the tendency to be more of a great, you know, supporting or character actor, but he's almost too handsome to be regulated to that. So, and that's not anything, you know, that's just, you know, genetics, and it's no fault to his own. But I think, you know, like I, for his first introduced to him on the Alias show, the J.J. Abrams show, where he kind of had a supporting role there. And then, yeah, kind of like comedies. And I don't, you know, I wouldn't say he was in like a whole lot of like rom-coms and stuff, but yeah, just kind of like the Hangover movies. And then you know, there's Joe Carnahan's A Team and stuff. But
you know, Wet Hot American Summer is kind of where he got
So and again, hopefully this is, you know, a different side of Cooper, just as this was a different side back in the day for audiences to see Tyrone Power. I know that I don't think that this movie did well when it came out. It was one of those things that I think the studio was really the book, you know, became quite popular, I think, a year or two before. And then it, you know, the studio optioned it, and basically, like, director Edmund Goulding had been assigned to it or latched onto it. He had previously directed, I think it was The Grand Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's interesting to see, like, something like this. And it's happened before where a movie, you know, that came out in the 40s and 50s didn't really do so well upon release, and then it became this kind of, you know, cult classic. I know for quite a while Nightmare Alley was hard to find. Like, it wasn't like on VHS, it wasn't on, you know, Laserdisc or anything like that. I think before this iteration of Criterion, there was, I think, a DVD copy of it, but that's about it. I think this is the first time on Blu-ray. Yeah, it was hard to find.
And I wonder, you know, I'm not as familiar with this movie as some people, but
mm-hmm.
it's such an odd little film that I can see why, especially if it varied from a very popular book. Like, if people read the novel and they fell in love with it, like, I want to go see this weird shit on screen. And then it's just not because of, you know, whatever cultural or studio kind mm-hmm. of issues were at the time. I can understand it not doing well and then disappearing and then being hard to find because no one was rushing out to say, we're going to put this flop out available for everyone. But, you know, people probably read about it and, you know, seen clips from it, you know, and other things and said, wow, I really want to see this movie. So the kind of the hard to find status of it turned it into a cult kind of phenomenon. And then when it did resurface, maybe it was reevaluated or possibly over evaluated as being this like great example of a movie that should be held up and given the Criterion treatment. I'm not trying to take anything away from it. I'm just saying that when I watch it, it's so odd that it's maybe it's because the carnival aesthetic, you know, you've got the tarot cards and you've got this kind of like carnival mm-hmm. poster, you know, design to everything. It looks, the aesthetics are weirder than the movie itself. And I feel it's not quite a bait and switch, but if you go in there looking at all this, you know, kind of artwork, and then you see the clip of, you know, Molly passing the lightning through her hands, like, that's about it. The rest of it is just like really well crafted mind games.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, this is not the thrilling kind of bizarre adventure. It's nothing like Freaks. If people are like, oh, this is a carnival movie from the 40s and it's kind of noirish, I bet it's gonna be like Freaks. It's not.
Yeah.
But that's not to say it's not good. It's just to say that it's, you got to kind of temper your expectations.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a journey. I wouldn't say it's a journey into madness, but it's a journey into, you know, just a kind of like a, I mean, it definitely has aspects of a psychological thriller at times. You know, I would say it's more of a psychological drama. You know, and it has the most intriguing part is really, you know, the figuring out where these characters are going to go, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, Power is very charismatic and everything, but it's also, you realize that there's, like you said, he's a complex character. There's so many layers to him and we're not sure what type of, you know, decisions he's going to make. And the interesting part of the movie is, you know, when this other character shows up, Lilith Ritter, who plays, or Helen Walker plays this character, Lilith Ritter, who is basically like a psychoanalysis or a psychoanalyst, you know. And it's very interesting. She could be somewhat of a typical femme fatale. I like how she's introduced, and I like how he tries to kind of corner her in a way to get her to, you know, fess up to the fact that, you know, try to get a line on her, as they say, or try to see if, honestly, to see if she has a line on him, if she's aware of his, you know, true nature and true ways, just to cover his own conscience, to cover his own butt. And I think she's a very interesting character, just because she's very much, you know, confident, in control, and is very nonplussed by so many people around her. Also, she is, when she's introduced to us, correct me if I'm wrong, but it is at one of his shows.
Yes.
And she's at a table with her, you know, friends and guests, and she, you know, because of, you know, her training and her nature, she knows there's something up with this guy. And then later on, when he goes to see her, I like how, like, when we first see her, she's at that event and she's in a gown and everything. And then later on in her office, she's in like these suits. And so not necessarily, definitely playing a character, even looking like a character who's more like, you know, in command, in control of the room, of the situation. Whereas that's typically kind of like how we see him. But he's a lot more panicky around her, or starts to become more panicky around her, and she unnerves him. And so I kind of like that.
Well, and he unnerves her, but she's far more kind of buttoned up and resourceful, probably right, because of her psycho training. No, yeah. What's fascinating is he uncovers. She is a mysterious character, because he discovers that she has these wax recordings, these records of every one of her client patient sessions. Mm-hmm. Unbeknownst to the people that are in her office, she's got these walls open up into these giant like wooden filing cabinets full of, you know, records of these sessions. Mm-hmm. And he kind of catches her like looking through these things. He's like, "What is that?" And she's like, "Oh, I record everybody." And he's like, "Oh, that's kind of weird." So it's unclear if she does that for, as she claims, just her own, you know, research and to take notes, or if it is some kind of blackmail tool, because she definitely turns that around and uses that on him in a spectacular scene of gaslighting, which I think is so ambiguous, even from a filmmaking point of view, because when things go south in their relationship and she actually runs him out of Chicago by claiming that the police are coming to get him for this, I think it was for money that he stole or something like that. She's like, "Can you hear, you know, here come the sirens?" Or he's like, "The sirens, the cops are coming to get me." And she's like, "I don't hear any sirens." Wait a second. So does she not actually hear sirens, or are there sirens and she's messing with them?
Yeah. Could be both. Yeah.
Right. But he's, you know, she is kind of reluctantly partnered with him at first, because he says, "Look, I don't think your clients would be too happy if they found out that you're, you know, recording them, you know, doing these clandestine sessions or whatever." And then she finds a way to kind of get the best of him.
Which is very funny, because, you know, that whole scene to me was like, okay, it makes sense that a shrink or a therapist would record sessions, you know, whatever, you know, you've seen that done before. And, you know, sometimes there's even, you know, whether or not the patient is aware of it, that's one thing. But, you know, typically it's like, okay, you're okay with recording these sessions and, you know, sign here. But
that was like, that's 70 years ago. I mean,
but it's like, coming from a modern audience now, looking at that, I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's no big deal. I guess maybe she was ahead of her time or whatever. But I could see from his perspective, like, hey, you'd be totally ruined if somebody found out that, you know, it's like, and she's just like, okay. Like, I could see her totally explaining, well, I do this for research. How else can I help these people without going back and really studying our sessions? I want to be present and involved in these sessions at the time, but I also want to go back and study them out and figure out what's the best way to form a prognosis or plan a figure out a plan of treatment. So she could have easily said that to the authorities or anything. So I could see her talking her way out of that. But as far as his situation, that's, you know, it's not as easier to, you know, grease through.
Well, Chicago, you know, especially at the time we're talking about, was known for its honest politicians and legitimate businessmen. So if any of them were on her couch, I don't think they'd be too pleased finding out. I don't care what research she's doing.
True.
They're going to break those records, possibly over her skull. But yeah, I really think that, you know, that dynamic, I love the way that things play out with all three of the women in this film, who he kind of goes through, and they kind of put each other through the ringer. There's Molly, who's the innocent, the young carnival girl who, you know, he kind of woos, and, you know, 'cause she's very attractive and also kind of very, like naive, as I said, they kind of go away together to do this act. The Xena character is also kind of enamored with Stanton, and he kind of plays that angle up mostly to get at the secret of this, right, this code. And then you've got, you know, Lilith Ritter, the shrink. She's kind of involved with Stanton, you know, more on a business level, but also you get the idea that, you know, it would be nice to hang out with this guy as well. There's, like we talked about, the idea of noir and double crossing and triple crossing. There's so much crossing going on in this movie. It's such a mess that you can understand why he ended up an alcoholic hobo at the end of it, regardless of his crimes, just dealing with these three, like this, you know, duo of femme fatales sort of, and then this innocent that he's just completely screwing over and messing with her head.
Yeah. I mean, she's not the only innocent that he's, you know, trying to screw over. There is that, you know, kind of like older aristocrat crack guy, Ezra Grindel, played by Taylor Holmes. And that whole scene was really almost kind of like almost next level, different type of movie altogether. And that the main scene that I'm talking about is when he's with Stan is with Ezra at his property, and you know, they see what appears to be some kind of like almost like an apparition or so. And I'm like, oh, this is just getting really interesting. And I'm not going to get, you know, into all of that, but I just love visually how that played out. And I'm like, oh yeah, I could see Del Toro doing something with this. You know, this should be very interesting.
That threw me. And at first I thought, is this like a bad edit or what? But so I'll get into it. I won't give the entire thing away, but I want to set this up. This rich, you know, business guy agrees to sort of finance Stanton's act because he is, you know, looped, you know, hooked by this. He believes that Stanton can, you know, has all these weird powers and can even talk to the dead. And there is an old love of his named Dory, who he says, essentially, I'll give you whatever you want, but I want to be able to see my long lost love. And so Stan goes to Molly and says, hey, we're going to be set for life. I just need you to pretend to be this dead woman. You don't have to interact with them. Just literally show up. You'll be several, you know, yards away, so there's no chance he can touch you. Just show up. He can, you know, say things or whatever and believe.
Sounds like a movie we'll be talking about later, but go ahead.
Which movie? Is this Licorice Pizza? No, I don't know.
No.
It's late.
We'll be talking about it after life.
It just sunk in. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be the conversation that you will have seen earlier this week by the time you watch this. It's very confusing. But but the thing is, during that conversation, they have a big fight, Molly and Stan.
Oh,
and she kind of walks out on it. Or at least we're led to believe that. And then cut to Stan and Ezra walking through this property. And he's like, basically, this is, you know, yours once I see my ex. And then there's an apparition, you know, in the garden. And that's as far as I'll take it. But it was kind of confusing. Yeah. I was like, wait, I thought she wasn't going to help him. How did that happen?
Right, right. Yeah, it's very interesting. And like I said, I think, you know, the cinematographer here, Lee Garmus, does a fine job. The art direction's great, especially in that scene. And so I just kept on thinking, oh man, I wonder what Del Toro's going to be doing with this. So,
and that's what, again, I'm going to reserve judgment. I'm probably going to go back and watch this after we talk about the remake and be like, Ian, you're a bonehead. I would say always
trust the first time.
Well, yeah, I'd say I up until what was that, the fish movie, the Academy Award, Shape of Water. I would say up until Shape of Water, I was firmly in the always trust Del Toro camp. Mm-hmm. So now I'm kind of like, I am mostly, but no, my concern is, I think it was handled just about perfectly in this movie. I think putting more of these supernatural flourishes on things, I'm like, I don't need to see, like, you know, Ezra thinking that he sees her like float and glow and all this other nonsense. You know, I don't need any of that dream like crap. This is just about perfect.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that it goes into more of like, not just delves into a lot more of like psychologically unraveling of not just Stanton's character, but, you know, how, you know, kind of longing or regret or guilt can kind of plague one's psyche. So, I mean, that definitely is what's happening with this aristocrat, Ezra Grindel. I mean, he is obsessed with that one love that, you know, got away. And so, you know, how is that affecting his, you know, psyche even now, despite his riches? That's the one thing that he wishes he had. So it can be somewhat of an obsession. So, you know, I could see that definitely being played up a little bit more, and maybe it was played up a little bit more in the novel too. Who knows?
Yeah. It also seems like a weird kind of spiritual connection to Citizen Kane, you know, that whole idea of the powerful businessman who just lost that one thing that kind of crippled him in a very key way.
Right.
Unfortunately, emotionally. But yeah, I really dug this movie. I'm glad Criterion put out. I'm glad you were able to watch the special features, because I did not get through hardly any of them. There's some nice cards, but no, it's, I think people should definitely check it out and give it a chance. And especially if you're a Tyrone Power fan who never watched this one, and you're like, oh, he's a great, you know, charming leading man. He's still charming, and he's still the leading man of this picture, but he's also sort of the villain with a little bit of redemption at the end, maybe, hopefully. Right.
It's interesting too, is that the essayist for the Criterion Collection is Kim Morgan. It's a great essay, but she also basically co-wrote the screenplay with Del Toro for this new one. So
wow,
she was that big of a fan. I mean, she's a film critic, but she also, you know, co-wrote the screenplay for this remake. So it'd be very interesting to see, you know, Del Toro and her collaboration, you know, again, what this, if it's more loyal to the novel, or what it brings, you know, and how it relates to today, should be interesting.
I just can't get over that there are people like that obsessed over Nightmare Alley.
I'm kind of glad there are, because the last thing we need is a remake of a really popular movie, you know. Well, oh, sorry, Spielberg. I don't know if he's watching, but
me and Steve go way back.
The beard. Again, this was a movie that for so long people had heard about but had not seen. So watching this one, I could see why Del Toro would have liked the original, but also would have, you know, also wanted to do something with his own stamp on it. So
Do you know, last question, do you know if the book is in print, or did they put out a new edition of it or anything?
I don't know if they should put out a new edition of it for, you know, because the fact that the new movie's coming out, but I briefly looked it up on Amazon, and I do think there's one out there, but there's also been a lot of different, you know, obviously a lot of different printings of it. Hmm. So, you know, I'm not sure what would be the best one to get or whatever, but.
Well, I'll do some homework for the both of us, and I'll send you a recommendation. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
All awesome. Right. Well, thank you for talking Nightmare Alley. Nightmare Alley. It's been so hard to not say
Nightmare on Alley Street.
Nightmare on Elm Street. Honestly, yeah.
Nightmare on Alley Street.
Ooh, Tyrone Power is Freddy Krueger. Things really didn't work out at the end of that movie. But it's been a lot of fun. And I'll be talking to you real soon about something else that folks may have caught on to during our conversation.
Probably. So.
Thank you, David Fowley, of Keeping It Real. Everybody watching or listening to this, make sure you check out his stuff. Subscribe and like this channel, this video, all that good stuff too. And thank you, and we'll talk again.